Hello, and welcome to Grim Fixation, a podcast about death gods, psychopomps, and whatever other spooky shit has caught my attention this week. I'm your host, Amy, and today we're going to take a look at the Headless Horseman. All right, so if you're coming back from my first episode, you might have noticed that I said this would be a weekly thing, and it's been a little bit longer than a week. Life happens. It's fine. I meant to record this earlier today, but my car was like, oh, you have the day off? Cool. I want to go to the service department at the dealership because yay. So anyway, it's a little bit delayed, but we are here. My research is ready. We're gonna nerd the fuck out. So grab a snack or drive or whatever it is that you're doing right now, and let's get started. So last week, literally last week, I was like, all right, I know what I want to look at for this week. I've got most of the research done. I just need to do, you know, a little bit of compiling of my notes. So I'm going to start working on future episodes because I'm one of those people who has to do 30,000 projects all at one fucking time. And then I can't complete any of them. It's great. It only drives my husband 90% up the wall. I'm sorry, honey. Anyway, so I was out and like shopping for mythology books, and I remember in my first episode, little naive Amy from last week was like, oh, I can walk into any bookstore and find a pile of mythology books. Yeah, turns out it's slightly harder than I thought or remembered. I was able to get some good solid books for research, and I'm really excited about them, like a lot. But the diversity was even worse than I remembered. Like, one bookstore, one of the Barnes & Nobles that I went to, literally only had, like, Neil Gaiman's Norse mythology book, which I still have not read, but I want to, and then books on Greek mythology, and nothing else. And it was stuck in the middle of the Western book section. Like, I'm fine with reading about cowboys. I've definitely read some good cowboy stories, but like, really? Mythology and westerns? The other one I went to had a slightly better selection, and I found some really good stuff there. Something that I might be doing like a book report style episode on next week. Depends on how fast I can read. It's coming soon. But it wasn't quite as easy as I thought, which is part of the reason for the delay on this one. And I decided to, like, start painting again and working on writing stuff. It's fine. It's fine. Like I said, 30,000 projects at once and none of them get done. Yeah, adulting. Anyway, so we're going to talk about the Headless Horseman. Now, growing up here in the States, I remember hearing about the Headless Horseman from, like, the Disney cartoon, you know, with like cartoon Ichabod and his little ponytail and coat and all of that, riding the horse that kind of resembled him because of the way the Disney animators work. And it was great. It was entertaining. And then when I was in like high school, I think, early college, the Tim Burton, Johnny Depp, Christina Ricci movie came out and I was obsessed. I think I had one of the promo pictures of like the little Sleepy Hollow village as my wallpaper on my computer in my room, like at my parents' house, for a solid year. And that was back when I used to change my wallpaper almost fucking daily. But I really loved that movie, particularly the blood. And I know that that's a really weird thing to be a fan of, but the fake blood that they used in that movie just had such an interesting texture and color, and I sound like a psychopath. But it's fine. It's totally a fun and normal thing to be a fan of, I promise. Right? Otherwise, why? I mean, you know. Grim Fixation, it works. It's on brand to be a fan of fake blood. I'm gonna move on. So anyway, in January of 2021, I got this idea for a fan fiction story. Something that I had kind of wanted to try out in my own original writing, but I wanted to adapt it for a very specific story that I'm still kind of tinkering with in the back of my head. And so I started researching death gods a little more seriously. And I came across this one called the Dullahan. It's a Celtic, Irish. I'm so sorry if those are not interchangeable. I'm a dumbass American. I am trying. Anyway, so I discovered the Dullahan, and I heard about that being the inspiration for our American Legend of Sleepy Hollow Headless Horseman, and I was like, dude, that's so awesome. I didn't know that it was inspired by anything. I mean, of course it is now. Like, I'm realizing everything American is inspired by somewhere else, and that's fine. It's not fine, but you know, it's the American way. We adapt things and call it our own. Sometimes we barely adapt it. Moving on. So I was like, once I kind of started to think about doing a podcast, I was like, Dullahan, that is one of the first episodes I have to do because it's just so interesting. So we're going to take a little browse through two parts of this thing. One, I'm going to dive into Irving Washington's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow story. I never actually looked up the word count on that to see if it's a novella or a short story. I know it's not a novel. That thing is shorter than some of the stuff that I've written. But still, I never looked it up. So we're going to call it a story, even if that's not the correct term. So we're going to take a look at The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and then we're going to dive into the actual origins of the Dullahan and what that creature, that entity, that psychopomp, is all about. And let's do that. So I had never actually read The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Like I said, I grew up during the Disney Renaissance, so pretty much every bit of mythology information that I had outside of school came from Disney, which means it was very skewed in one way or another. Anyway, so I never actually took the time to read the story before. And you know what? It's public domain. So I bought it for real cheap on Amazon, and I read it. And I went through my audiobooks, and it turns out that a couple years ago, I had gotten a free version of Tom Meissen, who played Ichabod Crane in that Sleepy Hollow movie from a few years ago, TV show over on Fox. He was narrating the whole story, so I alternated between reading and listening to the story, and damn, I never thought that I would have opinions, like capital letters, opinions, about a book that's over 100 years old. But anyway, I do. It's fun. So let's talk about some of those opinions. I hate Ichabod Crane. He is not great. And I don't mean like he's a badly written character. I just mean he is really annoying to me as a like person. Like in real life, he would annoy the shit out of me. He's very much that, like, I'm smarter than everyone around me. My presence, my knowledge is a gift to everyone around me. And I'm like, dude, shut the fuck up. Just shut up. Anyway, and I'm thinking Irving Washington felt much the same way. I'm just gonna, like, pop through some of the quotes and things that I found in the book that were really entertaining. Book, story, novella, I don't know, I don't care, it's one of those, it's fine. But I'm gonna just pop through some of the descriptions that really jumped out at me, and maybe you'll see why Ichabod Crane's not my favorite. So, very, very briefly, I want to touch on Irving Washington as a writer. So he is an American satirist, apparently. I didn't dive super deep into him because I might actually do a bonus episode on some of his, like, let's call it viral marketing schemes from, post-American Revolutionary War sort of thing. Or Civil War? I think it was Civil. I don't fucking remember. Don't remember. Don't quote me on any of these timelines because I was smart and didn't write any of that down. Anyway, from ye olden times. So I saw multiple places saying that Irving Washington wrote for a satire type newspaper or magazine at the time, or whatever the fuck they called it, that they, the modern people talking about him, equated to Mad Magazine, which, if you're not old, like me, and by that I mean 35, if you're not in your 30s or older, you may not be familiar with Mad Magazine. So let me give you a little history on that, because again, 30,000 topics at once, 30,000 projects at once, and none of it gets done. Anyway, Mad Magazine is like the Sunday comics, or in the newspaper, or the memes on your social media feed, but done in a way that would make your mom pissed. So when I was in high school, I think, my mom was super into going to garage sales all the time on the weekends. And one of these garage sales, I found a gold mine. Now, it wasn't literally a gold mine, but it was a cardboard box filled with paperback novels, or at least that's what I thought at first. But I picked them up, and they were all Mad Magazine in novelized form. So they were all these paperback books of the Mad Magazine comics, and I don't have the box anymore. I don't have any of the books anymore, and I'm really kind of sad about it. But I read those damn things cover to cover multiple times. And it's all like the Ren and Stimpy style potty humor that we as adults and weirdos probably grew up on. It was very formative, very tongue-in-cheek. So, Irving Washington, when you think of any writer from early 1800s or any book that's like classic literature that ends up on those required reading lists at school, you probably think something really boring. I mean, and don't get me wrong, this story wasn't like the same as watching, I don't know, the new Christopher Nolan movie or Avengers or some other like modern action movie or even a modern stoner comedy, but like it was still really well paced and good. Obviously, that's why it's a classic. That's why it stayed relevant for this long. But you wouldn't think of someone from that time making the kind of jokes that he does or writing something like satire. Then again, unless you have taken an interest into Shakespeare, you probably don't know that most of his plays are filled with dick jokes. It's great. Anyway, so I had no idea that that was where Irving Washington started, was with satire. I had no idea that he wrote comedy. Every time that I thought of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, I thought of these very serious stories, or even like sort of goofy cartoons and Tim Burton movies, which are always just a little goofy, a little off. But that's what I think of, is something that's a little more serious. But I never thought it would be like, well, here, let me find this. This is the description, the first description that we get of Ichabod. He was tall but exceedingly lank, with narrow shoulders, long arms and legs, hands that dangled a mile out of his sleeves, feet that might have served as shovels, and his whole frame most loosely hung together. His head was small and flat at top, with huge ears, large green glassy eyes, and a long snip nose, so that it looked like a weathercock perched upon his spindle neck to tell which way the wind blew. Basically, he's saying the dude looks a little funky, and that he looks like a weather vane. You might be able to hear birds, like demon calling outside. I apologize. They've been doing that for like the last couple weeks because the Southwest was one of the only parts of the U.S. that didn't freeze this month, or this last month now. And everything here seems to think it's springtime, including the birds. So if you hear, like, what sounds like demons, it's either my neighbors or the birds. It's fine. It's totally fine. Anyway, so Ichabod's a weird-looking dude. He's a weird-looking dude. And one of the other things that I love about this, other than the fact that he is a weird-looking dude, and Irving Washington is fine with telling everyone this, is that Irving Washington is known, like I said with that viral marketing thing, for writing under a pseudonym, and again, I kind of want to do a specific special episode on this. He wrote under a pseudonym a hoax guide for, like, tourists. So it would be like, well, sort of like a Welcome to Night Vale version of your local city's hotspots, where it's like, yeah, you know, instead of like, this is the grocery store, this is where you can buy cars, this is the bookstore, this is the coffee shop, it's like, yeah, this is the coffee shop and the monster that works behind the counter, you know, don't piss them off or whatever, you know, and then there's the spirits that haunt the driveway between the, like, it's hilarious. And so Sleepy Hollow is very much in that same vein, where most of the descriptions start, like, veering off from, like, look at the beautiful hills, to, and the people here are kind of crazy. It's fantastic. So let's see. Certain it is, the place still continues under the sway of some witching power that holds a spell over the mind of the good people, causing them to walk in a continual reverie. They are given to all kinds of marvelous beliefs, are subject to trances and visions, and frequently see strange sights and hear music and voices in the air. The whole neighborhood abounds with local tales, haunted spots, and twilight superstitions. Stars shoot and meteors glare oftener across the valley than in any other part of the country, and the nightmare with her whole ninefold seems to make it the favorite scene of her gambols. The dominant spirit, however, that haunts this enchanted region and seems to be commander-in-chief of all the powers of the air is the apparition of a figure on horseback, without a head. Like, who writes like that? It's hilarious. My favorite little bit was this one. Well, description of the people and the place. It is remarkable that the visionary propensity I have mentioned is not confined to the native inhabitants of the valley, but is unconsciously imbibed by everyone who resides there for a time. However wide awake they may have been before they entered that sleepy region, they are sure, in a little time, to inhale the witching influence of the air and begin to grow imaginative, to dream dreams and see apparitions. So basically, what Irving Washington is saying is, once you're in Sleepy Hollow, you just start seeing shit and having weird experiences, even if you're the biggest skeptic that has ever skepticed. That's a word. You're gonna start seeing ghosts. Now, a little bit of history or more on Ichabod Crane, which the Tim Burton movie got completely fucking wrong. Most of the Tim Burton movie is completely fucking wrong, to be honest, which is great. But Ichabod Crane is actually a teacher and likes to teach like church music as well, and singing, because he has such a great singing voice and everyone should learn to sing from him. He's really fucking annoying. Really annoying. Anyway, so he is a teacher and he takes advantage of the perks of that job, meaning that he goes around from each of his students' houses and like shacks up with the family for a while. Not like shacks up in a polyamorous swinger sort of way, but in a literal, hey, I've taught your child how to read, therefore give me a bed and feed me for a week. So he just sort of makes his rounds around the whole city and he carries gossip from place to place. Let's see. From his half-itinerant life, also, he was kind of a traveling gazette, carrying the whole budge of local gossip from house to house so that his appearance was always greeted with satisfaction. Yeah, they were real happy you were showing up to mooch on their food after spending all day telling people what to do in a schoolroom. I mean, it's great. Everybody should have an education. It's fantastic, but I'm just saying he's real full of himself. And at some point, he meets Katrina Van Tassel. He meets her. Now, she is the daughter of one of the real rich guys in town. And he's just like, oh my God, she is perfect. She needs to be my wife. Everyone else who is competing for her affections is a moron. I'm going to teach her to sing. And they're going to be like, obviously, you should marry my daughter, good sir. Have my fortune. This will be all yours. Because, you know, he's Ichabod Crane and therefore the best question mark? This was the thing. And he's not that great. And Katrina Van Tassel, for all that I could see in this story, yeah, she took singing lessons with him, but, I mean, I hate to use the term friend zone because I don't like it, but, Ichabod's an incel. He wants her. He does not care about Katrina as a person. He refers to her constantly as a coquette, which I had to look up the specific definition because I knew that word annoyed me. Because it's dismissive, but I didn't know the exact reason it annoyed me. So, a coquette is a flirtatious woman. And I remember that word from a Winona Ryder quote. Another goth woman from the 90s, and I love it. Right up there with Christina Ricci. Anyway, so there was this quote a few years ago, right around the time, or shortly before Stranger Things, I think, where she said that as far as the industry was concerned, and I'm totally butchering and paraphrasing this, she was too old to coquette and too young to cougar. Because those are the only thing women are good for in Hollywood. And once you're too old to cougar, then you can be the old lady in the background who dies tragically. Yay! Anyway, so it really annoyed the shit out of me that Ichabod kept referring to Katrina Van Tassel as a coquette and kept going on about her ankles, which I always thought that was a joke, and I'm pretty sure it's still a joke that Irving Washington is laughing about at him, but he literally goes on about her having, like, the most perfect ankles, and I'm like, bro, you need to calm the fuck down. Anyway, Katrina has, let's say, another admirer that, well, he's basically Gaston from Beauty and the Beast. His name is Brom Van Brunt, or Brom Bones. And this is the description of Brom. The most formidable was a burly, roaring, roistering blade of the name of Abraham, or according to the Dutch abbreviation, Brom Van Brunt. the hero of the country round, which rang with his feats of strength and hardihood. He was broad-shouldered and double-jointed, with short, curly black hair and a bluff but not unpleasant countenance, having a mingled air of fun and arrogance. From his Herculean frame and great powers of limb, he had received the name Brom Bones, nickname Brom Bones, by which he was universally known. He was famed for great knowledge and skill in horsemanship, being as dexterous on horseback as a Tartar. He was foremost at all races and cockfights, and, with the ascendancy which bodily strength always acquires in rustic life, was the umpire in all disputes, setting his hat on one side and giving his decisions with an air and tone that admitted of no gainsay or appeal. He was always ready for either a fight or a frolic, but had more mischief than ill will in his composition, and with all his overbearing roughness, there was a strong dash of waggish good humor at the bottom. So he's Gaston, but maybe less full of himself, by like 2%. 2% less full of himself than Gaston, but he is Gaston. And so he's kind of entertaining. And that's the main person that Ichabod is trying to, like, dissuade Katrina Van Tassel from going after. And it's kind of awesome because, well, here's the Van Tassel family and their opinion on who Katrina Van Tassel should marry. Balt Van Tassel was an easy, indulgent soul. He loved his daughter better even than his pipe, and, like a reasonable man and an excellent father, let her have her way in everything. His notable little wife, too, had enough to do to attending to her housekeeping and manage her poultry, for, as she sagely observed, ducks and geese are foolish things and must be looked after, but girls can take care of themselves. Hilarious. So much of that paragraph annoys me, but ultimately, they were like, Katrina can figure it the fuck out herself. She's a smart girl. She'll choose the right person. And so, I was really entertained by that little rivalry that Ichabod and Brom started to have together. And it kind of comes to a head when the Van Tassels send a messenger to the school where Ichabod is teaching, and the messenger says that the Van Tassels are going to be having a party and everyone is invited. So Ichabod's like, oh my god, this is it. This is the night where I'm going to go in and impress Katrina. And she's going to be like, oh my god, you're the one for me, even though you're just my teacher. Yay! We're going to get married. Yay! All your riches are now mine. It'll be great. And by riches, I mean Katrina's are going to be Ichabod's, not the other way around. Because again, he freeloads on his students. So he gets all excited and he gets so dressed up, you know, for however much he can afford to be dressed up. But anyway, Irving Washington gives an entire paragraph of drooling description of the food that's at this party. Like, it just went on and it was really funny. And then Ichabod got really, really up his own ass about his dancing skills. Quote, Ichabod prided himself upon his dancing as much as upon his vocal powers. Like, if you think I'm a good student, or if you think I'm a good teacher, you should see me sing. If you have seen me sing, you should see me dance. I can do it all, so long as it's not manual labor. In a time where manual labor sort of keeps us from dying in the winter anyway. After the food, everyone gathered to tell tall tales and spooky stories around the campfire. Remember earlier when I was talking about, like, all the things, the way that Irving was hyping up this city for being a little weird? Remember that. So they're sitting around the campfire telling all these stories. And one of the stories was from another person talking about their encounter with the Headless Horseman. And everybody was like, oh my god, he's so scary, you're so brave, I can't believe you survived. And then Brom hops in and he's like, oh my god, I ran into the Headless Horseman too. And he tells this even crazier story about how he just barely made it to this churchyard on time. And the Headless Horseman, Hessian soldier, had his head blown off in battle or cut off in battle. No one's really sure. Kind of seen it both ways. I don't remember how it's quoted in here. Actually, if I scrolled up instead of just babbling, I could tell you how he's described. Ah, indeed, certain of the most authentic historians of these parts, who have been careful in collecting and collating the floating facts concerning this specter, allege that the body of the trooper having been buried in the churchyard, the ghost rides forth to the scene of battle in nightly quest of his head, and the rushing speed with which he sometimes passes along the hollow like a midnight blast is owing to his being belated and in a hurry to get back to the churchyard before daybreak. Essentially, the horseman rides back and forth through the town looking for his head. He knows that it's buried in the churchyard, and because he is a ghost and because this is an American folktale at this point, ghosts are therefore demons or something and can't go into the church? Question mark? Atheist here? I don't know. But he rides back and forth, and if you get in his way, he's real cranky about it, and he will chase you because maybe you have his head. He doesn't know. He's headless. He can't tell if you're a church or a person. Maybe you're the person that cut his head off. He doesn't care. Anyway, back to Brom. He's sitting around this campfire, and he's telling this crazy story about, oh my god, you know, like I barely got to the churchyard in time for the horsemen to scatter past me. And at this point, like, Ichabod's a little worried, and so he's like, okay, you know, but I gotta tell a better story than Brom. I can't let Brom one-up me here. So he starts telling the stories about his home state of Connecticut and some of the spooky shit that he's seen, you know, when jumping at his own shadow, walking from student's house to student's house in the middle of Sleepy Hollow in the middle of the night. Because that's how he walks everywhere, is jumping at his shadow, like looking at, you know, the leaves and going, oh, what's that? Oh my god, what's that over there? Like, that is how he persists through life, but, you know, he's good. Anyway, eventually the storytelling comes to an end, and Ichabod delayed as much as he could. And this is where Irving Washington steps a little bit back from having Ichabod as a point of view to the author, the narrator, as a point of view, because he says that he doesn't know what went on with Ichabod and his brief meeting with Katrina Van Tassel, but it was a very short one, and Ichabod sort of ran out of there with his tail between his legs, because apparently singing and dancing was not enough to convince her that he should be her husband. Anyway, so he runs off in a shitty mood, and he starts his way through Sleepy Hollow in the pitch black to wherever the hell he was staying at that point. And all of the stories of ghosts and goblins that he had heard in the afternoon now came crowding upon his recollection. He had never felt so lonely and dismal. He was, moreover, approaching the very place where many of the scenes of the ghost stories had been laid. So he's walking along, away from the Van Tassel house to wherever the hell he's shacking up, and there's all these spooky things, and he's getting closer and closer to the path and the bridge where the Headless Horseman is, and he's like, I don't want to meet the horseman, I don't, but then he does. So there was this tree. I don't remember how it's associated with the Headless Horseman, but there is a tree. It is mentioned in this next paragraph. Anyway, as Ichabod approached this fearful tree, he began to whistle. He thought his whistle was answered. It was but a blast sweeping sharply through the dry branches. As he approached a little nearer, he thought he saw something white hanging in the midst of the tree. He paused and ceased whistling, but on looking more narrowly, perceived that it was a place where the tree had been scathed by lightning, and the white wood laid bare, Suddenly he heard a groan. His teeth chattered and his knees smote against the saddle. It was but the rubbing of one huge bough upon another as they swayed about in the breeze. He passed the trees safely, but new perils lay before him. And I realized I didn't copy all of the quotes I meant to get, so let's hop over to my Kindle app and load up my copy. Ah, conveniently it is right here. And we're gonna go to my highlights. Oh, sweet, they're not in here. We're gonna scroll through it and find this spot. I love when it's like, do you want to go to the most recent page? And I'm like, yes. And it jumps backwards. Thanks, Kindle. All right. So at some point, Ichabod sees what he thinks is the headless horseman on the horizon. And it says, Ichabod, who had no relish for this strange midnight companion and bethought himself of the adventure of Brom Bones with the galloping Hessian, now quickened his steed in hopes of leaving him behind. The stranger, however, quickened his horse to an equal pace. Ichabod pulled up and fell into a walk, thinking to lag behind. The other did the same. His heart began to sink within him. He endeavored to resume his psalm tune, but his parched tongue clove to the roof of his mouth, and he could not utter a stave. There was something in the moody and dogged silence of this pertinacious companion that was mysterious and appalling. Further down, he recollected the place where Brom Bones' ghostly competitor had disappeared, and he thought to himself, if I can but reach that bridge, I am safe. He thundered over the resounding planks, he gained the opposite side, and now Ichabod cast a look behind to see if his pursuer should vanish, according to the rule, in a flash of fire and brimstone. Just then he saw the goblin rising in his stirrups, and in the very act of hurling his head at him, Ichabod endeavored to dodge the horrible missile, but too late. It encountered his cranium with a tremendous crash. He was tumbled headlong into the dust, and Gunpowder, the black steed, and the goblin rider passed by like a whirlwind. The next morning, the old horse was found without its saddle and with the bridle under its feet. It was eating grass. In one part of the road leading to the church was found the saddle, trampled in the dirt, the tracks of the horse's hoof deeply dented in the road and evidently at furious speed were traced to the bridge, beyond which, on the bank of a broad part of the brook, where the water ran deep and black, was found the hat of the unfortunate Ichabod, and close beside it a shattered pumpkin. And then later, one of the last paragraphs of the story and one of my favorites. It is true, an old farmer who had been down to New York on a visit several years after and from whom this account of the ghostly adventure was received, brought home the intelligence that Ichabod Crane was still alive, that he had left the neighborhood partly through fear of the goblin and Hans Van Ripper, and partly in mortification of having been suddenly dismissed by the heiress, that he had changed his quarters to a distant part of the country, had kept school and studied law at the same time, had been admitted to the bar, turned politician, electioneered, written for the newspapers, and finally had been made justice of a 10-pound court. Brom Bones, too, who, shortly after his rival's disappearance, conducted the blooming Katrina in triumph to the altar, was observed to look exceedingly knowing whenever the story of Ichabod was related, and always burst into a hearty laugh at the mention of the pumpkin, which led to some suspect that he might know more about the matter than he chose to tell. So, if you weren't quite following, if your eyes and ears glazed over there, you have this story about this weird little town in the mountains of upstate New York. Or I believe it's upstate New York. Sleepy Hollow is part of New York. It is a real place. I just don't remember because my American geography is not great. Hi, American education system. Anyway, you've got this story that starts with a silly description of a silly place called Sleepy Hollow and the people that live there who are known to talk about like ghosts and fairies, and things that the author or the narrator consider kind of crazy. And you've got this teacher who is real full of himself, who is like, you know what? I am so smart. I am so great. Wouldn't it be awesome if this lady fell in love with me? She's so pretty. Her dad's so rich. I have no money. I am a teacher having to live out of attics of my students. It would be great if she fell in love with me and if her, like, lover boy there just fucked off. Like, he can see that I'm a better dancer than him, and clearly that matters in the game of life, right? And, you know, Brahm being, like I said, Gaston with, like, 20% less ego, he decides to pull a prank on the skittish teacher, and he plays up this headless horseman myth that everybody fucking knew, and adds to the story and adds to the tension right at this party, right when he knows that Katrina, who had already basically agreed, like, yeah, Brahm, I don't like him, you're awesome, we're gonna do this thing, but we gotta get rid of that guy. Because that's the other part of coquette. The other part of the definition is you're basically, like, flirting with a purpose. It's an interesting word. Anyway, she's got a good head on her shoulders. She can see the situation. She's like, I'm not interested in the singing coach. Like, he's fine, but we're just friends, okay? He needs to understand we are just friends. So Brahm's like, I've got this excellent idea. That dude jumps at shadows all the time. I'm gonna make him shit himself and leave the town. And then we don't have to worry about it. And that's exactly what they did. Katrina dumps his ass, says, dude, you're just my teacher. Please get out. You kind of creep me out. And Ichabod is embarrassed and he runs away. Instead of, I don't know, going on a mass shooting spree like some dumbasses these days do. Fucking stop it. Stop it. Anyway, moving on. And Brahm decides to play a little prank and he gets a little dressed up and he chases Ichabod through the woods and he throws a fucking pumpkin at him and makes him run the fuck away. It's great. I actually really enjoyed it. And I really enjoy that, unlike the Tim Burton movie, which I told you was full of shit as far as the story is concerned, Ichabod does not get the girl at the end. Ichabod did not deserve the girl at the end. He did nothing that she cared about. He had no interest in Katrina Van Tassel as a person. It was just a prize. So Brahm saw her and was like, hey, you've got a wicked sense of humor. Let's do this together. I fucking love it. So that's the legend of Sleepy Hollow. And it's great. I'm really entertained by it. And now we're going to have a little commercial break. We're going to talk about what inspired this story. I'm excited. Okay, so now that we've gone probably more in depth than I meant to, but it's fine, to the American version of the Headless Horseman from the Legend of Sleepy Hollow, let's talk about where it all began, or the best I can tell where it all began. Let's talk about the Dullahan, or the Dullahan, depending on where you get your information or what region of Ireland you're actually in. Sounds like they pronounce it a couple different ways. So Dullahan, means dark man, and it's considered to either be a fairy or the embodiment of this god Cromdub. Now Cromdub was worshipped by an ancient Irish king named Tigermas. Tigermas? Who sacrificed people, like all good kings do, to the god yearly by chopping off their heads. Now, according to this website, Shamrock Club Wikis, the ancient Celts believed that the soul of a person lived in their head. If an enemy was worthy, they would keep the enemy's head as sort of a trophy, and they'd also put heads on spikes outside of their settlements. So I saw two different explanations for that, and by I saw this, I mean I'm aware of two different explanations. Shamrock Wiki thinks that it's because the people believed that these headless, disembodied heads would scream if there were intruders on like their camps and everything, because they would put the stakes right outside their settlements. And so Shamrock Wiki was like, yeah, it was like a de early detection system, you know, an alarm, if you will. You put the heads out there and they go, ah, if they see somebody coming. But most of the historians I've seen outside of this specific research genre believe that the heads served as sort of a warning against possible intruders or people who were trying to, oh, I don't know, go against the king's wishes. So I'm gonna go with the warning option, not the screaming heads that don't have bodies anymore and are very, very dead option. That's just me. Anyway, according to gotireland.com, the Dullahan is known across Ireland, but the sightings of it are more concentrated around the counties of Sligo and Down. I apologize again if I did not get pronunciations right. So, you will see him, or people will see them, but hopefully you don't actually ever see him anyway. Sightings are reported around sunset or just after sunset when it's dark. On certain festivals and feast days, I've seen him linked the most with like fall festivals around like Samhain and other such harvest festivals. I couldn't find like specific lists of like he pops up on the third Wednesday of November, like every year. I couldn't find that. Everybody just said festivals and feast days, and I'm like, cool. So you just gotta like guess, but seem like the latter half of the year. And he's somewhere between a banshee. So a banshee in Irish mythology is usually a woman who screams when someone is about to die. It's warning of an imminent death. And specifically, banshees tend to follow like family lines or specific places. And if you hear a banshee's call, it's a warning to, you know, for instance, not get on that boat, or that kind of thing. And you can sometimes prevent the death that the banshee is calling out about, shouting about, screaming about. The Dullahan, yeah, he doesn't call out warnings. When the Dullahan speaks, which he is only allowed to speak once when he is out and about doing his thing, and the only thing he is allowed to say is the name of the person that is going to die. Not the person who might die, not the person who's got a bit of a tickle in the back of their throat, the person that's gonna be dead before dawn. And it's said that when he says that person's name, it draws their soul from their body. That's crazy. That's very like Ursula pulling Ariel's voice from her into the shell while she sings. Why are there so many Disney references in my head? I haven't seen a Disney cartoon in years. But, you know, that's it's formative, okay? Moving on. But yeah, so when he talks, people listen. And so he does not come to warn people. He comes to kill people. And there's some fuzziness about whether he's a psychopomp or not. So if we go back to episode one about the Grim Reaper, I explained that there's sort of differences between the types of death gods and death-related entities in mythology and religion and folklore and all that. You have death gods who, rule over like the dead or the worlds of the dead or the realms of the dead or specific types of death, things that cause death like disease and war and all of these things. And then you have Death with a capital D, who we started seeing pop up around the Black Plague era, usually a skeleton, later sort of became the Grim Reaper like we see now, scythe, robe, all that. And then you have psychopomps, and those are specifically god-like entities who take a dead person's soul from one realm, which is life, to wherever the hell they're going afterwards. Possibly hell. They are an escort or a messenger, and sometimes they announce the death, sometimes they bring them with them. Mostly it's the bringing them with them and announcing, but I couldn't quite tell from the folklore about Dullahan if you would consider him a psychopomp, which I'll get into in a little bit. So, like I said, he does not come to warn anybody. He rides out, only is able to speak once, and pulls your soul from your body when he says your name. Now, let's talk about the way that he looks. So, Headless Horseman, you don't get a lot of description of him in Irving Washington's books. Most of the adaptations of it have him either in some sort of, and I believe this was Revolutionary War, it has to be a revolutionary, because now that I'm like putting the fragments of information I have crammed into my skull together, I remember that Irving Washington also wrote Rip Van Winkle, which was based on a guy who fell asleep, like, somewhere, I think out in a field or under a tree or some shit. I didn't actually read that one again. So this guy falls asleep before the Revolutionary War. We in America are still part of the colonies. We are still under the monarchy of England's rule. And then the war happens, and we get the United States of fuckery, of America. And Rip Van Winkle wakes up, and it is a whole different world in his eyes. He's like, holy shit, how long was I out? And so, yeah, Revolutionary War. Where the fuck was I? Oh, the appearance of the Headless Horseman. He will either be in Revolutionary War soldier uniform, or you'll see him in like all black robes and the uniform underneath. Those are sort of the ways that the Headless Horseman from Irving Washington's story has been adapted into different versions now. So the Dullahan also shows up in flowing black robes, just like the Grim Reaper and a lot of other psychopomps that we use now. And he also has no head on his shoulders. Again, he inspired the Headless Horseman. So everything that I've seen pretty much says that he has his head with him, different from Irving Washington's I'm searching for my head Hessian soldier guy. Dullahan, he carries it around with him. And there's a few different descriptions of it. Most people agree it is unsettling and disgusting, as, you know, a disembodied head would be. Some say the skin is like mottled cheese. Some say it's got leathery skin. Almost everybody is like, yeah, it has a smile that goes literally from one ear to the other, just crazy wide. No thank you. No McFucking thank you. And it has, the head has supernatural sight, which, I mean, it's cut off from the body. One would assume if it sees anything, it's gonna be powered by supernatural forces of some kind or another, so I would fucking hope so. But apparently, this head has either beady little eyes or just eyes that dart around every McFucking where. Everywhere. They be looking everywhere. And sometimes it'll just be like chilling in his hand or under his arm and just looking all over like a crazy, I don't know, cartoon or something. Or like a little pinball machine, pinball. Or the Headless Horseman will lift his head up, probably by the hair. That's what I'm picturing. I doubt he would like hold it upside down by the neck. That'd be a little gross, a little squishy. You're welcome for that visual. This is how my brain works. So he holds his head up and he'll just like use it like you would use, I don't know, a lantern or a flashlight, and have the eyes just look around everywhere. And apparently he can see all, which is a little weird. I mean, we're talking about a dude that is animated with his head dismembered from his body in his hand. But, you know, that's the weird part. So, yeah. The head, a little bit different than being buried in a churchyard. And if this Headless Horseman in Irving Washington's story, if we go with, I don't know, American Gods from Neil Gaiman style rules, and it was an entity, a god that, you know, Irish immigrants brought over to the US who became corporeal, and then somebody was like, oh, I'm gonna steal your head and bury it here. He's probably real pissed. Might be why he throws pumpkins at people. Just saying. Anyway. So, in addition to carrying around his gross, disgusting, disembodied head, the Dullahan also carries a weapon. It's a whip made from a human spine because he's a dick. Also, like, I can sort of see, like, a Spirit Halloween store style, like, human spine whip. And it's hilarious. I'm like, dude, costume of the year, somebody do it. Show me pictures. Anyway, so that's him himself. In episode one of Grim Fixation, I went over, like I said, the Grim Reaper origins, and one of the inspirations for the Grim Reaper is from this Celtic part of France called Brittany. Brittany? But they had this psychopomp called Ankou. And Ankou drove around either a plague cart or he captained a boat along the coastline to pick up souls of the recently deceased. So, like the Ankou, the Dullahan also has two different modes of transportation. One is a horse, and the other is a carriage. Now, the horse, that has a few different versions. Sometimes the horse is just black with, you know, flames for eyes, because that's a normal thing that horses have. Totally fine. No, like, oh god, I'm gonna have nightmares about that or anything. It's totally fine. So, black horse, flames for eyes, totally golden. Great. The other time, the horse also doesn't have a head. That's just fucking rude. No one needs to see a headless horse running around, ever. Like, a headless human, as a human, that's plenty fucking disturbing. We don't need to be hurting horses. Stop it. Don't do it. Let them have the flaming eyes. I'm not cool with it, but I'm much more cool with that than having a headless horse running at me with a headless rider. Don't like it. Not cool. Not sure if the horse also somehow carries its disembodied head. We're just gonna move on. So that's the way that the horse by himself is. And then there's the carriage. So the carriage or coach, whatever. I'm going to use those words interchangeably, but I think it's technically a coach, quote-unquote. That's pulled by six horses. Thankfully, every description of those six horses, it sounds like they get to keep their heads, which is much less rude, and I'm happy with that. So they get to keep their heads, and they get to pull this coach. And the coach is called the Coach a Bower, and it comes from the Irish phrase, or the Irish term, whatever. I'm gonna butcher this, I apologize. Coast Boder? I'll write it in the description. Meaning deaf or silent coach. Now, some descriptions of the carriage just say it's black. He rides a black, or drives a black carriage with black horses. It's great. Other times, this carriage is heavily decorated with human bones. Because he's chill. So he'll have, like, human skulls for lanterns to, like, help light his way. And use, I don't know, thigh bones as the spokes in the wheels. Like, that's just great. It's, really, really multi-purpose there. You know, the using the whole crew. Okay, moving on. So we're gonna pretend that that's not a thing, but it is. He uses human bones to decorate his coach. Regardless of whether he decides to just take one horse or all six in his big ol' Pimp My Ride coach. Goth My Ride. Anyway, whether he's riding the horse or driving the coach, every version of the story agrees that he goes real fast. Speed limits do not apply. None at all. He goes fast enough that he sets fire to the bushes behind him. So sparks will fly from the hooves of his horses where they strike the ground, you know, with their little horseshoes. And sparks will fly off the wheels of the coach. And it's not bueno. It is not good. He even goes fast enough that no doors or gates will remain locked or closed in his wake. So he'll just fly through town, and every gate and every door will unlock and pop open. Which, you know, I mean, if you're a resourceful person, kind of, I don't know, looking for an easy way to make money, you might think, oh man, I just need to, like, wait for one of these fall feast days, follow the Doulahan around, and then I can just, like, walk into people's houses and score shit, right? Yes, but also you really should not. So let's talk about what happens if you see the Doulahan. Because remember, if you see the Headless Horseman, he chases you because he thinks that you have his head. Sort of like a dog when it thinks you have a treat or something. Except nightmares. So if the Doulahan sees you, because the Doulahan sees all. So if you see the Doulahan while you're out, well, in some versions, he will just be really, really calm, and he'll just, like, whip your eyes out with his little human spine whip, blinding you, which is aggressive, to say the least. And in others, you've just earned yourself the right to be the next person to die, and no, all of you people on the internet who are very on board with that, just calm down. I mean, we all want you here. Just calm down. Don't be running into that. Anyway, so that's a thing. You know, other times he'll just throw his head at you. You know, so Brom and his prank with the pumpkin, not far off. He'll just throw his head at you. It's disgusting and smells putrid. May or may not be leathery or mottled, you know, it's fine. Or he'll just pour a bucket of blood on you, very Carrie style. Not sure where he gets the blood or the bucket, if that's like hidden in his robes, like a, I don't know, what do they call that in video games? A bag of holding? Or D&D? I don't know. I'm not that kind of nerd. You know, it's just the robes of holding. He'll just reach in and it's like, oh, my whip, you're gonna lose your eyes. Or, oh, it's my head, I'm gonna throw it at you. Or, oh, look at this blood. It's gonna go bad. I better throw it on your face. It's weird. But, you know, I mean, you're not dead. So maybe don't, like, storm chase the psychopomp hoping to break into people's houses. Don't break into people's houses. Don't be a thief. Don't do it. But, I mean, if you've still got a case of the sticky fingers and you still think, for whatever fucking reason, that risking human spine whip to your eyeballs is a good idea, you might be able to survive an encounter with the Dullahan with gold. So, couldn't find a reason for this. Everyone's like, yeah, fucked if we know. I don't know, maybe he has, like, an ex that was a leprechaun, and now he's, like, traumatized for whatever reason. I don't fucking know. But apparently, if you throw gold coins onto the path between you and the Dullahan, he's just gonna, like, stop and run away. Just like, oh, god damn it, you had to pull out the gold coins, there you go, I can't do this anymore, and he'll just fuck off. And, like, that's fucking weird. I mean, the whole thing is weird, but, like, that's really fucking weird. So, yeah, I mean, like, even if you don't believe the myth, if you happen to be in Ireland during one of the fall festivals at some point when we aren't all dealing with a plague, pandemic, whatever, and you happen to, like, look out the window in the middle of the night and you see, like, a brush fire on the horizon, just close the fucking curtains and put on headphones so you don't hear him, like, trying to call out your name or anything. Like, it'll be fine. If you're walking around, maybe keep some gold coins on you or jewelry. I don't know. They said even a little bit of gold. I wonder if does he care about the carats? Like, does it have to be pure gold? Like, can you just get something gold plated and just, like, wear it? I want to know how judgy he is. I mean, like, judgy enough to throw his head at you or whip your eyes out for seeing him. Like, how dare you judge me in my head that's decomposing in my hand? I don't know. But, I thought that was just a very interesting entity. Like, who thinks of this shit? I mean, humans. People. We come up with weird shit, but it's fascinating to me. So that's the Dullahan. And there's no real, like, specific point for when he started to appear in, like, folklore. It, definitely sometime after that King Tigermas? I don't know. But no one's really fucking sure. And it definitely seems like some people like to put it around the same time as Europe started seeing death with a D. You know, big capital D is ominous and grotesque instead of welcoming and nurturing, which is something that I went really deep into on the Grim Reaper episode. If you're curious about more of that, definitely check out episode 1. But we're not really sure when the Dullahan came out. And by we, I mean me and all of the sources that I hit up. But, you know, do any of you know? Have any of you heard a different version of this? Are you from Ireland? Do you have Irish, you know, relatives or people that you know who have told you some other version of the story? Let me know. I want to know. I'm curious. I'm invested now. All right, so now is the time where I ask you guys a question. What other tall tales in American folklore are inspired by something older, something from another realm? Like, what other stories do you and I tell or hear while we're growing up that you know that come from other places? I mean, I remember hearing about where jack-o'-lanterns come from and things, but like, is there anything that's not from Europe that we all talk about here in the US? I want to know. And which one is your favorite? Whether it's death related or spooky or not, I want to know. Give me a shout out. Instagram, Twitter, email, any of those. You can find Grim Fixation at GrimFixPod. That's GRIMFIXPOD. That's the same on Instagram and Twitter. Or you can email me, grimfixationpod@gmail.com. Fixation is a whole word there. I might have to get a secondary email. It's fine. Or you can find me, Amy, at Amy Rose Books everywhere. That is AMI. Rose like the flower, books like what fills your shelves. I'm everywhere under that name. And so, yeah, let me know. What am I missing? What have I not talked about yet? I know it's a lot. I have a huge list of things that I want to cover, but if there is something that you want to see, let me know. Anyway, today's death-related pop culture reference of the day, the song Barton Hollow by the Civil Wars. Because it's such a fitting song for this Headless Horseman episode. It's very like, I don't remember what they would call it because I haven't been listening to country music all that long, but it is definitely considered sort of a country song, sort of a folksy song, sort of a bluesy, maybe. It's give it a listen. Barton Hollow, The Civil Wars. I really wish they'd stuck together as a band for longer. Anyway, this song talks about being a quote, dead man walking while being pursued by the devil. And they're basically walking through all parts of the world trying to get away from the devil, but there is no escaping it. And it's perfect. It's the perfect tie-in for being pursued by a headless horseman. Because to be honest, I don't want to meet the headless horseman up in Sleepy Hollow. And I definitely don't want to see some moldy cheesehead or human whip spine thing out in Ireland. I don't want it. Do not want. And so, Barton Hollow, give it a listen. Thank you for listening to Grim Fixation. I will talk to at you later.